Hi, everyone. Welcome to Waste 360's Nothing Wasted podcast. On every episode, we invite the most interesting people in waste, recycling, and organics to sit down with us and chat candidly about their thoughts, their work, this unique industry, and so much more. So thanks for listening and enjoy this episode.
Well, thank you, everybody, for being here today. I'm John Shigarian. I'm the co-founder and CEO of ERI, Electronic Recyclers International. I'm really honored to be moderating this panel of great leaders on the outlook on recycling today. This is the second or third year that I've been asked to do this. It's always an honor. As a little bit of a background, I've been banked by Co-America since 2007, and it's been the best banking relationship in my professional life. And my company would not be the leading brand in its sector without the partnership of Co-America Bank. So for that, Joe Irsay and your team, I just want to say we're very grateful and thankful for all you've done for ERI. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce the three great leaders that we have here today. They're going to give a little bit of background on themselves, and then we'll get going with the panel. Alan Handley is the CEO of Lakeshore Recycling Services. Jason House is the CEO of Demcon Companies, and Will Herzog is the Western Regional Sales Manager of MachineX Technologies. Alan, can you please go first and give a little bit on yourself?
LRS is the largest independent waste and recycling company in probably the greater Midwest outside of Ohio. Probably pretty close to $370 million in sales, about 1,500 employees and 27 sites in six states around the greater Midwest. And by volume, we control close to 35 to 40% of the outbound waste out of Chicago, and we, unlike most of our competitors or any of our competitors in the region, other than maybe Jason, we recycle pretty close to 50% of that material and keep it out of the landfill. So we have a pretty unique value proposition, both to drive EBITDA, but also to preserve airspace at our landfill. So we put a lot of time, effort, treasure, thought into keeping material out of the landfills at almost any cost. So happy to be here and thanks.
Thank you, Alan. And Jason, you want to give a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yep. Jason House, CEO of Demcon Companies. We're a third-generation, family-owned and operated company based just south of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Company was started in the 1960s. We operate three landfills in the state, single-stream MRF, C&D MRF, a couple scrap yards, roll-off company, and some long-haul trucking. Happy to be here and see how the session goes.
And Will, give a little bit about yourself, and then you're going to lead off with the first question.
I'm Will Herzog with MachineX. MachineX is a designer, builder, installer of MRF processing systems. We're actually celebrating our 50th year. A very long and convoluted process to try and throw a 50th birthday party during COVID. So if anyone has a chance and wants to stop by the booth, we're actually going to try and do a live live session with our manufacturing site tomorrow during the day. Prior to joining MachineX, I've actually worked in the processing side of the industry for a couple of different private companies. So I understand the equipment side from both sides of the transaction.
So Will, we're going to let you lead off, but of course our other panel members can jump in as well after you go first here. Many of the people in our audience collect recyclables and bring it to a third party. When trying to figure out if you should internalize it and build your own MRF, what are some of the key considerations that should be made when you're making that decision?
So first I want to clarify, you're asking an equipment sales guy if someone should build a MRF? Yes, you should. To me, it all starts with volume. And not only the volume that you control on your own trucks. The MRF operator that I work for, we actually didn't run any trucks of our own. Is an understanding of how much volume is available in the market and what are the economics required to be able to capture that and bring it through a facility. in my prior life, we actually built a completely commercial facility up in New York State without a contract and without any material on our own trucks, just because we knew the market well enough to know that we could secure the tons. Knowing what the volume is and what it's going to take to be able to secure those are probably the single most important factors to deciding whether or not it's going to make sense economically.
Jason, same question for you. What are some of the considerations that people in the audience should consider when thinking about internalizing recyclables instead of outsourcing them?
Yeah, it's interesting that with Will's answer, I would have probably guessed that there's two people at the entire Waste Expo that would build a facility without having their own trucks delivering to their single stream plant, but we're one and the same. You know, we have open top roll off trucks on the road, but we do not collect any single stream. So we built our plant. We were completely reliant on third party haulers to facilitate hauling material into our plant. And I think it comes down to knowing the marketplace. You know, we built our company and our business on looking at the market and looking what the unmet market needs might be. And at the time, we needed MRF capacity. So we knew the market, we knew the haulers, we were able to build those relationships. And that was our business plan and our model to put that single stream plant up. So I don't think you're gonna hear that answer very often. Typically it's a lot of internalization that happens, but I think for us it worked just because of us being in that market for so long, understanding the customer base and being able to provide them a service that they needed. For us it was a unique time, and I don't think in that same market, it's not going to be that way all the time, but when we built our facility in 2007, that's the way the market was presented to us.
Thank you, Jason. How about you, Alan? That cleanup on that question, I'm sure you have a take on this issue of recyclables and operating a MRF and key considerations.
Yeah, ours is a bit of a different play than Jason's. Obviously, we started building that MRF as an offensive weapon back in 2015, and it obviously did well. So 15, 16, 17 was a great, you know, we internalized a lot of volume. We underwrote the business plan based on a combination of our own volume, which at the time was probably 30% of our own internal volume. The rest of it was third party volume. And that worked out real well. And so I think the key consideration is that you have to look at the market you're in, understand the infrastructure that's in place that you're going to be competing with, and then also understand that the market's going to flip on you. So we were offensive for 3 years, and then 18 and 19, anybody who's lived through recycling, those were the horror years for me. That asset became a defensive weapon. So I was able to protect my market, maintain margin, and service my clients, where a lot of the people who were third-party customers of ours got hammered because they didn't have the optionality of having their own system, and they were a victim to the commodity market and the profit I need to make on my MRF. And so I think it's a combination of, I always tell people, make sure you understand that this market isn't gonna be like today. Like, this is a great year, right? 2021's been a great year, 20 was good, but I have vivid, I wake up in sweats on about 18 and 19.
Speaking of such, Alan, you take this and then let's go through the panel on this. You know, it's always great to get best thinking and lessons learned. What's the best lesson you've learned? You've lived through the down, now we're back on the up. Any best lessons for people in our audience with regards to the whole journey you're on?
Ambien works out real well for some of it. I think in all seriousness, like when I look back in 18 and 19, Machinex built our system and they're very good friends of ours. And even though Chris is too important to come to this tonight, he did a really good job. But I think that what we learned is you need to be nimble. And so, again, I mean, Jason, your flow may be different than mine, and I'm sure there's people in this room that have different flows than what we have, but you guys remember, the mixed paper market just went to hell, right? And we found out that we had too much brown in ours, and we wanted to convert that to OMP. OMP was moving, and so we put an optical in to kind of deviate and recharacterize our stream, and that made it sounds silly and kind of pedestrian, but it was millions of dollars of EBITDA savings that we picked up by just making that quick move. And I think the other thing we learned too is labor is the death knell of recycling. So the more labor you have on your lines, if you're in a down market, even in this market for different reasons, that's a hill you will die on, in my personal opinion. So removing labor, keeping yourself fluid on technological improvements, making sure you understand the composition of your material, and sometimes letting stuff go. So there are times where you're like, it's not worth picking it because there's nowhere to go with it.
Jason, same question. Best lessons? Is labor one of the great lessons, removing labor? Or what are the thoughts do you have on that question?
Yeah, I'd probably take more of a holistic view on our approach to getting into any type of a business. That just because the market's good doesn't mean you should get into it. I think you have to look at it from a long-term perspective. And I think anything we jump into, it's analyzing it, it's understanding that, hey, we're gonna be in this thing for the long term through the good times and the bad times. You know, we opened our MRF in 2015. The market was good for a little while when we opened it, and then it completely went in the toilet. And then it's come back, and it's gone back into the toilet, and it's come back again. But I think it's building the contracts that work, that are sustainable, and it's not a quick get in and make a bunch of money and get out when the market's really good. That's another lesson from our scrapyard facilities too, that just because the scrap metal markets are great doesn't mean you should jump in and be in the scrap metal business, because those markets are volatile as well. So if you're gonna get into that type of business, put the capital up, you have to have a long-term approach to it. Otherwise, you'll pay the price at some point, because the market will drop out on you.
Will, I'm going to put you on the hot seat here. When you're bidding on these deals, how many quotes are your potential clients getting, and how competitive is this process?
And these guys can probably answer the question better than me, because I only know what we bid on.
Right.
generally speaking, I my operating expectation is that there are probably at least three, and maybe as many as five and six, depending on the size, scope of the project, the location matters. There are always a handful of smaller companies who are trying to get into the single stream business. But you know, there's, in addition to us, there's three other guys who are all here at the show that we jockey with every day.
Jason, this one's for you. If Alan said, obviously everybody's labor challenged today. I mean, when we get up this morning in Las Vegas, we see it's hard to catch an Uber or a taxi because of labor issues that exist in every industry today. If labor's going to be an ongoing challenge, is robotics and AI becoming part of the MRFs across America, is something that you've experienced yourself just yet?
For sure, yeah. I mean, we were the second facility besides Alpine to put a robot in. We have an AMP robot in our facility. We were the second one in the country to do it. I'm bullish on all of the type of automated equipment, whether it's optical sorting or robots. You know, I think our robot performs well. It's not the end solution for your entire MRF. They have their spot and they work well. But you know, our facility was built with one optical sorter in. We're putting our fifth in over Labor Day weekend. So, I mean, it's constantly upgrading that equipment to make a better product and to help supplant some of the labor issues that you have. And it's not necessarily wanting to get rid of the headcount. It's just there's no headcount to be had.
Right.
So we're trying to engineer our way out of that.
Right. And is the optical sorters are all powered with AI?
Yes.
So they're self-learning and they're continuing to learn.
Continual to learn, and I think it's performing really well. I think we're looking at other locations that we can drop another one or two into our system. And even above and beyond just the robot and the mechanical part of the robot, there's other ways that you can use the technology that they have on the front end of their robot to help manage your system and try to continue to find additional margin using that technology that's out there.
Alan, do you feel the same way? And is that something you've deployed in your facilities as well?
Yeah, I think we were the third person to put a robot in behind Jason, all off the AMP situation in Colorado. For us, it's exactly what Jason said. I mean, we're constantly looking for ways to, and it's both. I think by removing those heads, it actually makes recycling more profitable, and it actually can encourage more recycling. So I have a little bit different view, though I can't find second shift labor right now to save my life, so it helps. But yeah, we're more robots, more opticals, that's sort of what we're gonna do. So.
Sticking on this operational theme of MRFs, Will, what is the messaging or education that you give generators of recyclable materials to make the recycling easier process for everybody out there, all recyclers?
Yeah, it's been the same message really since I was in the business in the early 2000s, and I've talked to people from 10 years before that. Put the right thing in the right can.
Right.
I mean, it's really not terribly complicated. As a person I used to work with once said, we've been trying to educate the kids how to recycle since the 90s. Those kids aren't kids anymore, they're adults, and they still don't do it right.
Right. You know, Jason, you know, the Biden administration now seems to going to be getting their infrastructure package through, and everything seems to be pointing up in terms of green, and we know this is a good time with regards to commodities. What is some of the offensive measures you're taking now to buffer any downturns that come in the future? Because we know what goes up does come down at some point. These are good times now. What are some of the offensive plays that you're making now to prepare for when things get a little softer?
Yeah, I think for us, it's just making sure, because we are 100% third-party hauling coming into our single-stream MRF, that it's all about the contract that we have with our haulers and the trust that we have with them. It's making sure that the contract is fair in all market conditions. You know, we the contracts that we have developed, we don't get the high highs of the market conditions, but we also don't get the low lows. It's a shared risk and reward with our customers. We're transparent about what the economics are on the back end of the sale of the materials, and we do audits of their different materials, and they're given a benefit or a drawback depending on the quality of material they're delivering to our facility. So it's really working with them in a true partnership to make sure that there's a win-win for both us as the processor and them as the hauler. And, you know, when single stream recycling first started, everybody thought that it should be free, you know, because the markets were good when they started. And we all know that it's not free. I mean, the cost to process single stream is probably more expensive than it is to process MSW. So for us to be able to have a sustainable business, you have to put contracts in place that are fair to both sides. You know, when we had the significant downturns, we heard MRFs were failing, people were going back and renegotiating contracts. We didn't have to do any of that. We didn't renegotiate one single contract, because what we had done up front, we stuck with it. We had customers that didn't come on board with us because they didn't like that scenario, but the long-term effects of having a good contract, I think, have paid off for both us and the hauling community.
Alan, same question for you. What, as you said, things are really good right now. You lived through the hard times in 18 and 19. 20 started, things started turning, and things seem to be really boiling hot now. How are you preparing for the future ahead?
Yeah, like my prelude was, I'll never forget 18 and 19, right? So, you know, there won't be any more floor cap contracts any longer. I think we're smart about how we bid residential work. There's been a lot of blood and pain on the streets in Chicago. So I can only really speak to the markets I'm in, but in Chicago, people made foolish mistakes on the flawed theory that recycling was going to continually always be an upward trending sort of paradigm, and it's just not the case. So I think you have to be reasonable, to Jason's point, about how you view the actual cost of processing a ton of single stream, being agnostic to what the end value is, because I know I think you have a sharing mechanism. We don't share, because I'm greedy by nature. So it's just being more intelligent, not chasing it. And I'll tell you, in Chicago, no one's going to be chasing those contracts anymore. It's not going to happen. People are putting negative 30, negative 40 in their bids. I know that, and I think that's going to stay. Yeah, so I think that for me, it's not going to reap the benefits today, and then if the downturn occurs, we'll be fine, because we bid it properly. We bid landfill pricing into the recycling contracts.
Will, for your company, is this considered a boom time, and how do you take advantage of the times that we're in right now, and how are you also preparing for the future ahead?
It's definitely a very busy side in the equipment side of the business. We've been fortunate in that we've been able to secure a handful of big projects over the last, you know, year or so, which is good, because it means that we've got a good full order book. It's painful at times, because we've had to not be able to fulfill requests from time to time, because we are quite busy.
My request.
Yes, I know. I was sitting with Chris when he had to make that call. So it is definitely a long-term planning question for us, and making sure that it's sustainable. I mean, Machine X, like I said, we've been around doing this in the recycling business since 450 years. And, you know, we are owned by, you know, just as you guys are, sole proprietor ownership. And he takes, you know, we have 400 employees building equipment in Quebec. He takes the responsibility to keep them busy very seriously. And so we don't try and jump out at market opportunities and expand too fast and then find ourselves having to go through downsizing things. We try and take a very long-term view.
You guys, this panel obviously is about the future of recycling and the recycling industry, the current status of it in America. You know, it seems as though when you study circular economy behavior, ESG behavior, Europe and other smaller countries in Asia, such as Japan and South Korea, have had a jump up on us, culturally speaking, from the United States. But now you can't turn on the television or read an article in the Wall Street Journal covering our industry without ESG, circular economy, being part of the investment theses that seems to be here and scaling at a faster rate than ever before. Do you feel that that's going to positively affect the recycling industry, because there'll be more recycling going on, both from the professional side of it, which you three represent, and the next generation behind us are going to be recycling more because this is what's on their mind: sustainability, green behavior, circular economy, as we switch the linear to circular economy. Is this really here to stay, or is this just the investment trend du jour that's going to fade in the future? What are your thoughts on that? Will, I'm going to let you start off.
I think the growth of recycling over the last 20 years has been fairly consistent. I mean, you know, it's ups and downs and swings, you know, I might date it more to 2016 through 19, not 2018 through 19 of the downturn in the commodity side of the market. But no one that I talk to in the industry or in the public sector ever talks about anything other than, why can't we do more? Why can't we recycle more? It's very much of a constant presence, I find, that everyone just anticipates and expects that there should be more recycling. You know, I live in the Phoenix market, and I, you know, periodically will have people tell me that, you know, there's no recycling in Phoenix, and I used to run 4 MRFs there. So, you know, people like have a high expectation for recycling. I don't think that's going away.
Jason?
Yeah, I think it's here to stay. I think there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a education program that we call Green Grades. We have a full-time educational professional that works for us that she's part of educating all of our local communities. We have tours that come in. She goes out to the school. We've developed curriculum for it. We bring students and parents and groups in for tours. And I'll be honest, I mean, the parents are terrible at it. You know, the kids are pretty good. You know, we try to target fourth grade, so all of our local fourth grade communities around us are who we try to target. They're at the right age where they can be safe, they can understand it, they can take it back home. But I think it's here to stay because that's what people expect. I think education will become better. I think we need to do a better job of working with the manufacturers of producing products to make it easier for us to recycle it, because the problem is we're held accountable for products that can't be recycled. You know, they'll take a look at LRS or Machinex or Demcon and they'll say, well, you're missing all this material. Well, you can't recycle a chip bag, right? I mean, it's challenges that we're left holding the bag, and no pun intended, but it has to start somewhere else besides looking at our facilities. And I think that's a difficult proposition to make, but I think recycling's here to stay. People expect it. There's only so much we can do as we sit today, but I think we'll get better, but it'll be incrementally better. It's tough to move the needle in a large fashion with what we have to deal with today.
Alan, what are your thoughts on that?
As you can imagine, I'm going to take a contrarian view, because it's who I am. I think wishfully recycling is here to stay. So I think that, yeah, everyone wants to recycle. I think that the way that we set this country up and say, well, it's got to be driven by the consumer, and then we have to process it, and somehow that's going to be an effective solution, I think is flawed. Because I sit inside our MRFs, I see what people put in their recycling, and it's wishful at best, and it's negligent at worst. So I think until you make this a more, to your point, Jason, more of a producer, start with a producer and drive it that way, that's how you're going to get real recycling. Because I think you have to have it go from the packaging, and then have it make it real simple on the consumer. Because the average consumer, frankly doesn't care, in my opinion. Some do. I can't speak to everybody, but I think most don't. And I think until you fix that, until you really, really make it from the top, the producers down, we're never going to get there. And then I hate to say, because I'm a sort of a libertarian at heart, I think that you have to have much stronger, some type of government overlay or an incentive to make it really work. Because the free market in recycling, in my market with low tip rates and low tip rate environment, capitalism always prevails, and they always find the easiest, cheapest way to get things done. And that flies in the face of really recycling, which is expensive. So I think we have a much further way to go than maybe you guys do. So,
regardless of political affiliations, if the Biden administration gets their infrastructure plan through, from where you sit in the region that you operate in and do the most business in commerce, do you believe it's going to be a benefit to your business, specifically speaking? Alan?
Yeah, I mean, so we, on multiple fronts, not just with recycling, but we are working with Tiffany, who's a grant writer for us, and she's doing an awesome job. And there's a lot of money, both on the DOT side, multiple different government agencies, and we're talking about tens of millions of dollars of grant money and low interest rate loans that we're gonna use some of those funds to seed almost a $40 million new MRF down in the city of Chicago. That's directly being driven by some of the policies that have been put out by the Biden administration. So I do think that those things will encourage infrastructure, recycling infrastructure, and other recycling-oriented infrastructure. So no, I'm bullish on that.
Will, how about you? You cover the Western region, obviously. Do you feel this is going to be a boom for your business if this makes it through?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard from a number of, more on the public sector side, of public sector solid waste divisions of cities and towns, that yes, absolutely are seeing that there's capital available for them to make direct investments into new facilities. So, and that's not even through a grant process. It's, cash is available.
You had other programs, like you had Closed Loop Fund, right? Who I think, I don't know if you guys know this or not, but they already were providing sub-bank level financing to organizations. And so I think even before the Biden administration came around, there was funds available from, whatever you want to call it, more progressive-orientated institutions to fund large-scale projects where typical bank financing may be difficult.
Wonderful. Jason, for you, the same question, if this administration gets this package through.
Yeah, I mean, I'm bullish on it as well. I think there's going to be money available for grants. I think that will help build new facilities, purchase new equipment, add equipment to an existing facility that helps upgrade your ability to recycle, help with headcount issues. So I think there'll be some benefits related to that. And that's on the single stream side. On the C&D side, I think you'll see some hard infrastructure, bridge building, road building, different things like that, that'll help at least our business on the C&D side as well.
From where all of you sit, it seems as though one of the bigger issues and challenges that all waste companies are facing today is this issue of the proliferation and ubiquity now of lithium-ion batteries and the dangers that associate with them. What are your thoughts on the best practices around lithium-ion batteries, education as well, and how to prevent, obviously, the four-letter word of fire in a facility? Jason, you have any thoughts around lithium-ion batteries?
Yeah, tell the manufacturers they can't make them anymore. I mean, simple. I mean, the problem is there's millions of them out in the market right now, so we're going to have to deal with them to a certain degree. But I just don't understand, for a product that creates that much risk, how we can continue to manufacture them. I mean, our MRF has, we have a fire every couple weeks, right? I mean, they may be minor, but we're, knock on wood. But it is a risk that every single one of us have to deal with. You can put mitigating practices in place, but at the end of the day, it's not if you're going to have a fire, it's when and it's how many and how often. And it comes down to the manufacturers in a product like that, they refuse to remove the recycle symbol on a battery. And to me, I think that's the problem. If you want government intervention, let's get government intervention at that level to not put a recycle symbol on something that we all know is an it's a risk to our facilities, it's a risk to our infrastructure, it's a risk to our employees, and we can try to educate that part out of it, but that is incredibly difficult to educate communities of millions when we can get the manufacturers to do better.
We can't even get people to recycle normal things.
Exactly. Right?
So, I mean, we just talked about this, and now you want them to figure out what's got a lithium battery in it, which, I mean, they proliferate everything, that even ones we don't think about it. It's crazy.
Do any of the three of you have best tips in terms of technologies to remediate the fire risks from batteries?
Yeah, I mean, for us, we have a couple fire rovers in a different few of our facilities, and they've worked well. I mean, they've saved significant damage. I think there's different technologies for different facilities. If it's an existing facility, I think a system like a fire rover is a good one to be able to implement, because you could put it anywhere you want. We built a transfer station that we built new from the ground up.
Right.
So we were able to implement other technologies in it that we could cover the entire facility. We didn't have to do it in a boxed package like fire rover is, but there's different ways you can do it. But there's a lot of things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, and I would have to say fires are the thing that keep me up at night.
I agree with you. There's 10 minutes left, and I want to leave it open now for any questions. Are there any questions from the audience for our three great panelists? Yes. Yeah. Is there a microphone here? Up here they come. Over here on the front. The young lady's bringing it up.
I think this panel is brought to you by Fire Rover.
It's a race among the two ladies.
They're not even in the room.
the blowback is hard.
Yeah, no, the echo is bad.
Thank you. Thank you. Please say who you are and ask your question.
My name's Dylan. I'm a co-owner of an electronic recycling company in St. Louis, Missouri. And you guys didn't really go over it too much or at all, I guess, but our major problem with any electronics coming in are CRTs. And I would like to know what a big scale level, what kind of progress is being made for that at least, because most people will just simply put it under their trash bags and their trash can, or just simply keep it, for another 20 years, because the few places that do recycle it, they charge, out the butt just to get a small TV done. I'm curious if there's any efforts being made to make it more cost effective.
Gentlemen.
I mean, for us, we accept them, we charge for them, we charge by the weight for them. So if you have a really large TV that, the old wood ones where there used to be, wood built around them, they're really expensive to get rid of. So people are going to take those tactics if there isn't a better program. We're lucky our county has a household hazardous waste facility that they can take them to and get rid of them for almost nothing. So that helps alleviate a little bit of that pain for us. But, I mean, it's an issue with everything. People are trying to sneak things into their garbage can that they know shouldn't be in there. And there's probably not a great solution unless there's a local government agency that's willing to have sort of a take-back program.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we see them, and we get, not just that they'll throw them into roll-off boxes.
They're a mess.
I don't think we're making any, I haven't seen any progress. We're just doing what we're doing. We're taking them to another facility, and they process it. We don't do that.
More questions? Just raise your hand. There's one right in the middle there.
Hi, thank you. This was touched on briefly, but I was hoping it could be expanded on a little bit. Is there any tips or advice for structuring fair and equitable contracts kind of with your customers that both mitigate the downside as well as kind of the upside?
It's a great question. Alan, you want to take that?
Yeah, we tried that. I think, Jason and I have talked, and I think Jason's got I was very curious about how Jason did his, so I think that you could probably get in a situation in a proper contractual relationship where you have the ability to sort of share on the upside and limit some downside exposure. But again, you need to really understand, you said it earlier, Jason, if you have a good relationship with your haulers, you have haulers, yeah. I think that you can probably pull that off. When you have a relationship with a city, it's a much different conversation, because moving that around and renegotiating what I consider sort of force majeure events. The China situation in 1819 was about as close to an act of God as I could come up with. So I don't know. I have a hard time with the municipality side of it. I think you can probably get there with your haulers. We do a little bit of rebates and what do you want to call it, profit sharing, whatever you want to call it, with those, and it works. But the municipalities are tougher, and I don't know if I have a solution other than I just bid it at an appropriate level to cover disposal and let it be. So.
Yeah, I mean, a couple thoughts I have on it is we don't have any contracts with municipalities, and the reason why is because they hire consultants to write their contracts, and we'll walk away from those contracts every day of the week because they're bad. You know, they'll want a floor where, regardless of what the market is, they're going to want a minimum that they're going to get paid for their recyclables, but they also want no cap on the top end if the market's really good. And we'll simply just walk away from those contracts and not bid them, and we'll get a call 2 days after the RFP is due and say, well, why don't you bid the contract? We said, well, your contract was terrible. Then we're not going to bid that contract. So all of our contracts are with individual haulers, and we're transparent with them, we're fair with them. And really, it's a fee for service, and we get a little bit on top of that if the market's good. You know, most of the, you know, we've been in business for quite a few years on the single stream side. Most months, the haulers are getting a check back. There are a couple months where they'll get a small invoice in the mail, but overall, they're getting money back, and it's been a fair and equitable way to do it, and we keep those customers year after year after year, and the renewals still come. So, you know, there's a lot more detail in it than that, but we stay away from the city stuff because it's just too complicated.
Yeah, think about the city one. Like, even if you had a fair contract that you gave the city to be reasonable-minded about, they're not real fluid organizations. And so look at the pandemic, which is a great example. You know, the volumes on the residential side went through the roof, as did recyclables. If you would have had an old contract that we would have had back in 15 and 16, it would have already taken a bad situation for our residential division and exasperated it to a point where I can't even imagine. And they have no ability to understand that what we do is valuable, right? So it's this contract, it is what it is. So I have a much harder time and less sympathy on the residential side, on the municipal side, than I do on the hauler side, because they're unforgiving.
More questions? Raise your hand if you have a question. Going once.
Here's one.
Okay.
Could you talk about examples of when it makes sense for customers to not recycle?
Alan, Jason, Will, let's talk about not recycling.
When does it make sense for customer not to recycle? I mean, the issue is, at least in the areas I'm in, there's you don't really have that optionality, right? There's no longer that option. So, I mean, other providers in the marketplace that bury trash and recycles together and take it to the landfill, I know they did it in 19. During COVID, people were forced to because they had nobody on the streets, and so there was issues there. We would never do something like that because there's too much scrutiny and people will, you know, there's cameras and videotapes and it would just be, it's a problem. So we stay away from that. But I think that during COVID, there was a lot of pressure to, on the recycling side, at least on the route side, because the routes are down, the volumes were through the roof and people were doing things that they probably wouldn't do in a normal course. But I mean, like you said earlier, I think recycling is here. There's a public a perception of it that you're not going to get around, and so I don't think there's going to be a situation where anybody's going to let you, like, we wouldn't let you take single stream and dump into our landfill. It's just not going to happen because it'd be in the news. So I don't think that's going to, not least in my markets, I don't think it's plausible.
Yeah, and I would say in our markets the same way. It's actually illegal.
Yeah, in Wisconsin it's illegal. Illinois it's not illegal, but it's might as well.
Yeah, in the state of Minnesota, if it's a source separated material, it's illegal to landfill it. So, you know, for us, it's here to stay. It's not going anywhere. And people just need to understand that there's a cost associated with, and if they, within their community, believe that that's what they want to do and they want to recycle, they have to also be willing to pay for it.
I think that's actually one of the bigger shifts since the commodity market crashed, is that, you know, the recycling industry built itself on the commodity side for 25 years. Since the China sword and the crash of the commodity markets, everyone's had to accept the fact that it's a fee for service, and that's actually a pretty significant shift in the way the recycling industry operates. And the fact that it would, you know, I was in the middle of renegotiating some of those contracts, right, back in the day. actually transitioned really quick. I'm surprised it went that transition was able to be executed as fast as it was.
I think the transition occurred more on the hauler side. Yeah. I still think there's a lot of lag and on the municipal side. We're burning off contracts that still have onerous terms in them.
Yep.
But I do agree with you on the next turn of that contract. There's not going to be, like you said, there's not going to be floors and caps and all that nonsense anymore. That those days are done. And I do agree it's a service-oriented business now, much more so than it was before. So it's really about service. You're providing the service. We're very clear about what it costs to process a ton. It's just different. And I agree. I think the 18-19, while it was horrific, I think probably the long-term was probably beneficial.
Yep.
We have time for one last question. Any questions before we... Up there.
So one of our major items that we get, obviously, from dismantling our electronics, and we've had the most difficult time trying to find at least a downstream for it, at least in the St. Louis area, is ABS plastic. I'm curious on what solutions you guys maybe have been able to find to send ABS plastic to, because that seems to be like the most hard, difficult plastic to recycle.
It's tough. I mean, I think we accept it. We don't send very many truckloads of it because we don't get a lot of volume, which makes it challenging to move it as well. But it's you got to be creative, whether you're moving the material yourself or you're utilizing a broker to do it for you. It's finding an outlet that's willing to take it, but it's tough. I mean, we'll sit on some loads every once in a while for quite a while. Luckily, we don't get much of it, so we can sit on it for a little bit. But every once in a while, the market will pop. We'll find somebody that's looking for it, but it's not something on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis we're moving out the door because there's not a readily available market for that material.
Seems to me that's a challenge in a lot of different sectors of recycling. I mean, you guys are both also involved in C&D, and that's one of the C&D recycling has a big problem of we can sort a whole lot of stuff, but it's hard. You don't always necessarily have a market to take it to.
Well, it's that, and the pricing vacillates. So, transportation, there's a lot to it, right? It's not just the, I can sort, we sort, what, 26, 28 items, whatever it is.
Yep.
I can find a home for most of it, but can I move it? And then I have a limited infrastructure to store it, and so sometimes it recycling loses to to utility.
With that, I want to say, let's give a round of applause for our panelists today for their great job that they did. Thank you again to Waste Expo, the BLF sponsors, and of course, Co-America Bank. Our next speaker is going to be Dustin Fornari. He's going to lead the next panel. He's the Senior Vice President of Commercial Risk and Surety at Hub International. Come on up, Dustin. Thank you again, everybody.
Thank you for listening. It would mean the world if you would take a moment to rate or review this podcast. And if you share it with us on one of our social networks, we are giving out some fun, Nothing Wasted podcast swag. So just tag us and see what you get. Thanks so much.